He's our voice of reason in the medical world. Dr. Fred Brown from Griffin Health talks to Melissa in the morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Good morning, Dr. Brown. How are you?
I'm well. How are you, Melissa?
You know, I can't complain. Thank you so much for asking. Happy June.
Absolutely. Happy June.
So let's talk about, I know you and I have discussed this once before, a dangerous fungal infection spreading at an alarming rate across the country, including New York and New Jersey. I always say it incorrectly, but I think it's Candida auris.
Pretty close. Candida auris. Yes.
Candida? That's how you say it? Okay. I always get nervous that I'm going to say Canada, and that's not what I'm trying to say. Candida. Got it. Candida auris.
And some people do say Candida.
Oh, okay. I don't even know what I just said. I think I said Canada. I don't know what I said. But yes, that's what I'm talking about this morning. So what is it?
So it's a yeast is what it is. So the first thing is that, you know, when we talk about fungus, there's sort of fungus breaks up into yeast and actually fungus. In our mind from the medical world, that's kind of two different things. I know they'll say fungal. Both are fungus. But yeast are a little bit different because as far as everybody would know, yeast is what causes yeast infections. So infections that are caused by either throat infections or vaginal infections, other infections that can actually be caused by yeast. So this is one of those things that it's concerning from the aspect of it can be misdiagnosed, but it is still relatively uncommon and only affects a certain group of people.
How do you even get a yeast infection?
So the typical way you get a yeast infection is there's actually two major ways to do it. One is antibiotics. And I think you and I have talked a lot to say that, you know, taking antibiotics is not necessary, unless it needs to be done, it's not necessarily something that is just sort of a routine thing. If you take antibiotics, it really should be for a purpose. So limiting the amount of antibiotics is important because one of the aspects of getting too much antibiotics can lead to overgrowth of other microbes. And one of the microbes that grows is yeast. So if you're on antibiotics, you can get an overgrowth of yeast. The other way is certain types of steroids, in particular inhaled steroids, so steroids that are used to treat certain types of asthma and COPD. They can decrease the immune system in the mouth and throat, mm-hmm. and then it'll get rid of the bacteria and then allow the yeast to overgrow.
Yikes. So then why are we seeing this issue, but this fungal infection, why are we seeing such an uptick across the country?
Yeah, so this organism in itself, Canada as a species, is relatively common. The most common cause of yeast-type infections is an organism known as Candida albicans. That's probably the most common. I mean, it's very common. When we talk about a potential yeast infection, then that's what we're really talking about, is we're talking about an infection that actually is there, and again, it's probably about 90% of the time it's going to be Candida albicans, which is tricky because it can be relatively hard to identify and treat if it's not albicans, and that's sort of the tricky part about this organism. Now, the good news is this organism is mostly associated with the elderly, infirmed, and hospitalized.
That's why we talked about this.
Yes.
This was months ago that we talked about mm-hmm. this, that we were starting to see spikes in hospitals across the country.
Correct.
Why is that the case? Just because they're not clean?
No, and that's not necessarily that. I mean, these things do spread. And as we've seen with other viruses, we've seen sort of spread throughout the country, right, throughout the world, different viruses. Bacteria and microbes are very similar. You know, they are carried by humans, and humans carry it from person to person. Sometimes we don't know exactly how they're carried, but they can be carried within hospitals. So that's definitely a possibility. They can be carried or been seen from the outside. The reason why it occurs in hospitals, again, because people are sick. They're on steroids, and steroids decrease the immune system. They're on antibiotics, and that eliminates the bacteria but doesn't eliminate the fungi and the yeast.
Okay. So what can people do? It was interesting because I said to my intern, Katie, she said, you know, what are we talking to Dr. Brown about this morning? And I said, well, we're going to talk about this fungal thing going on. And I said, it's really prevalent right now in New York and New Jersey. She's like, well, why don't we just keep it right there? But I, you know, as kind of a joke, but not really, because it's so close to us. How do we get it back under control? Like, is there a way, or is there a reason we're seeing such a spike now? Like, why now?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's going to be good infection control practices that keeps this contained. It is also the awareness that it is out there. So one is that we need to know that it is in the area, so then the healthcare professionals can test for it. So if we have someone who does have a yeast infection, again, some ways this is relatively easy to identify, some it's not. So if it's in, let's say, if it causes an infection, a serious infection in the blood, we will grow it in the blood cultures. So we'll be able to look at it from that standpoint. It's when it's just there is a little trickier. So we need to make sure that we're swabbing people and that we're checking to make sure that they don't have Candida auris. And then when they do, then we need to use proper precautions to prevent that from being spread around a hospital.
How do you treat it, Dr. Brown?
So there are antifungal medications. The majority of them are IV, but there are some medications that we can use. It's not the reason why this is a problem is it's not the typical treatment that we would use for Candida albicans. It can be relatively resistant to a antimicrobial called fluconazole, which is actually a very commonly used antimicrobial and antifungal. It's actually it can be resistant to that, and that's part of the problem also. So if someone has a yeast type infection, then we can give them this antifungal, and then, you know, it goes away. If it doesn't go away, then obviously we need to do more work to determine it.
And another thing, Dr. Brown, how common is it for us to have like this fungal infection outbreak? Have we seen this before?
We've known about this organism for a while. It's been relatively, I know it's sort of sensationalized now and sort of seeing it and going across, but this has actually been going around for 5-10 years that we've been watching this organism. And because of its ability to spread, you know, the use of antibiotics, we've been able to somewhat contain it, but it's also somewhat inevitable that it's going to continue to be present in the healthcare settings. And again, I say healthcare settings, but also nursing homes.
All right. And so we're talking to Dr. Brown about this, a dangerous fungal infection that's spreading at a very alarming rate across the country, including right next door to us in New York and New Jersey. Are we seeing it in Connecticut, or are we controlling it well enough that it's not making the headlines?
We are controlling it very well. I think we look at a lot of different organisms that are resistant. I think the Department of Public Health has been very helpful. They have a list of microorganisms that if we identify them in the lab, get reported to them. And then they help us sort of define what's there, what areas there are, and if there's potential any outbreaks that we see.
Dr. Brown is here, our infectious disease expert on WICC. And I wanted to switch gears a little bit, Dr. Brown, and really get your take on this. Because you and I have talked about this, and we sort of were touching on it a little bit when we were discussing fungal infections and how sometimes when you're taking too many medications, it actually could be really bad for you. So, for example, you and I have talked about, you know, my son with his chronic ear infections growing up and getting that medication. And if you take it too many times, they almost become immune to it. It's not great for them. I'm curious about Ozempic and these quote-unquote weight loss medications, because they're not weight loss medications. They just found out sort of, I would say on accident, that it was making people lose incredible amounts of weight in a very quick amount of time. And so while you were on vacation, I don't know if you heard about it, but Jenny Craig shut down a lot of its weight loss centers. It's going away for good. And one of the biggest reasons for the mass layoffs and just sort of closing down shop is because of new prescription drugs like Ozempic.
Right.
What is the long-term effect if you are someone who is relying on something like an Ozempic to give you your weight loss dreams come true? What happens to the human body? That is just so unnatural.
Yeah.
It's
really tricky to say, because, listen, this is a good medication, and it's, you know, it's really helped with people who have diabetes. I mean, it really is a good drug. So we need to be careful about, but I think people just need to be careful. It's a drug. You know, and certain types of drugs, unless you have a medical condition, certain types of drugs, if you're taking it when you're normal, is going to have certain types of side effects. Now, we know that there's going to have, obviously, immediate or regular side effects, you know, when you do take this. You know, the nausea, the vomiting, and, you know, diarrhea are very common when you first start the medication. The question is that when you take a medication like this only for the purpose of weight loss, and when you don't, you're not diagnosed with diabetes, the answer is not, we're not sure. I will tell you that everybody knows that the way to lose weight is really eating right and exercise. I mean, that really is the right way. And to prevent eating right and exercising could cause other issues. So that would be my concern about using this medication just for weight loss. We have had countless other weight loss medications that have been on the market that have actually caused a lot of problems. I'm not saying that this one will, because again, I think this is a little bit different because it is a side effect. But I think you're right, Melissa. I think we've talked about this a lot. You know, this is not, there's always a risk benefit in this aspect. So taking a medication like this can lead to later side effects. The question is that we're just not sure what they're going to be, or at least I can't tell you definitively what they're going to be.
Mm-hmm. I find, Dr. Brown, that I hear that a little too often, that we just don't know. And I don't mean with Ozempic. Now I'm sort of jumping around and I'm thinking about another, I'm going to call it medication or remedy, if you want to call it that. But sleep aids, for example, and melatonin is one that I used to use really when I would struggle sleeping when I first got on this shift. And in recent years, I find that I have to really have gone 5 or 6 days without good sleep before I take melatonin. And my biggest fear is that we just don't have conclusive evidence as to what the long-term effects are. That's like so scary that we don't have long-term effects on things that are relatively very easy to get your hands on. Like Ozempic,
yeah,
for example,
absolutely.
You don't have to be a diabetic to get it. I mean, I've heard of so many people getting Ozempic without any diabetes in their family.
Correct.
None.
Right.
That's crazy. Same thing with melatonin. That's over the counter. You can just show up and get it. Why is that a thing?
So it's actually interesting because melatonin is considered a vitamin, and vitamins are not, you know, do not need to go through the process for drug discovery. In fact, you can get, you know, even though the concentration, there is a concentration on there, you know, is it really a concentration? It's really more managed by the, it's not managed by the FDA. I think it's agriculture that actually manages it, you know, Food and Drug Administration.
Oh, so FDA is, okay.
So, no, I'm sorry. It's actually a special category. So it's not Food and Drug. I think it's, whatever Department of Agriculture. I'm just blanking on that.
Yeah, Department of Ag. Okay.
Yeah. So I think that's where it is. So it's actually in the category of a we call them nutraceuticals. So they're nutritional aids.
It's like a supplement.
Yeah, it's a supplement. And because it's a supplement, it doesn't have any regulations. Therefore, it does not need to go through any studies to be on the market. It just needs to show that it doesn't cause any harm.
I don't like
that's really about it.
I don't like that.
So concentrations are different. There's a multiple different areas that are associated with these different types of vitamins. People sometimes forget, you know, there's a big difference between different types of vitamins. There's a, you know, there's vitamins that are water soluble and there's vitamins that are fat soluble. Fat soluble vitamins stay in the system and you can get toxic with them. So you can get vitamin toxicity. which could be pretty severe. So vitamin toxicity is a real thing. And we do know that there's been some overdoses with melatonin. In particular, they've come into gummies. And we know that in the pediatric literature, we're seeing a lot of children who are actually having melatonin overdoses, which is, again, is a major issue. So, yes, it's one of those, you know, that's a supplement. It needs to be used as a supplement. It, you know, at low doses, it seems to be helpful, but not harmful. So I think we're pretty good with the melatonin. We know it's helpful. I would tell you that I'm probably happier that people are using melatonin than the alternatives, which are going to be those sleep aids that fit into a category called benzodiazepines. So medications that are sedating medications that are prescription and, those can be, you know, addictive. They can lead to lots of different problems. So again, and I think in the medical world, we're like, okay, melatonin, we'll have to deal with that.
It's like the least of our worries.
Exactly.
I mean, is it better than, like, I mean, I feel like back in the day, if you had to go to sleep, you would take like NyQuil, even if you had no symptoms of like ailments, you just needed it to go to sleep. Is melatonin still better than taking like a NyQuil if you have no other symptoms but that you're tired?
So clinically, I would say yes.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because NyQuil, so certain types of NyQuil, Benadryl is another one that are commonly taken. The problem with both of those is that if you take, you know, they're not really designed that way. And then sometimes the NyQuil had alcohol in it. That's not, you know, you don't get a good rest with that. The Benadryl may have a rebound effect, and you have to continue to increase the dose to get the effect, and can lead to pretty significant side effects. So again, I think the vitamin is probably better than those to take if you have to take something on a regular basis.
Got it. Well,
I would not throw out your melatonin. I think melatonin is still a really good over-the-counter. Just make sure you have a high-quality product that you're using. I wouldn't get the cheapest one you could find.
Right. That's I do have it, and like I said, it's really when I go a good stretch of like I haven't slept.
Have
it, and it's from a reputable place. Okay.
Then that's a great way to do it.
Okay, cool. I trust you. Dr. Brown, always appreciate you. Thank you so much, and we'll see what we dive into next week.
Absolutely.
All right. Have a wonderful day. Dr. Fred Brown of Griffin Health right here on WICC.